I have to admit, I am hooked. I am hooked. I'm watching more Bravo than I ever have in my life. I mean, I am hooked on the Olympics. Just love every sport. They could be juggling. It doesn't matter. It would be the best people in the world juggling, and I'd be watching it. Just incredible stuff. And I'm gonna talk about that in a moment because there's something about that video and actually a story that emerged this week out of the Olympics that connects to what I want to talk about today. But first, I just want to say hi. I'm Chuck. And I'm one of the pastors around here if you're brand new to Crossroads. I just want to give a special welcome to you. I've been on staff as a pastor for about 5 years, but I've been around this community for about 11 years now. And just really excited that you're here and hope that many of you are going to join us this Wednesday as we open the Florence location. It's going to be awesome. Not open it, but celebrate and dedicate it being open in a couple weeks. It's going to be really cool. Love to see you there. But I've just been just riveted by the Olympics. And, you know, one of the things that I see in that video, and it speaks to me, is these athletes are not only defined by their successes, but there's this backstory for so many of them, and they're actually defined by struggle as well. They're defined by the difficulties and some of the setbacks that they've had to experience. All of those things together have shaped them to be who they are. And in the midst of this series over the last 6 weeks of The Good Life, basically, what we've been saying is Jesus came to introduce the life that God intended. And that life includes love and joy and peace and patience. But that life exists in a context of reality. And so what we've been saying is the good life that Jesus offers is not circumstantial. It's not only the good life when we're experiencing good things, but actually there's a part of us that is shaped and formed and refined, even enhanced, when we experience difficulty and setback. And so today I want to talk about what does it look like to view the good life in the midst of a world that does have pain and suffering. And I know some of what I talk about today is going to be a bit heady, and I just encourage you, if you can hang in there with me, this heady theological stuff has deep and very practical implications in our lives. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. But I was struck by an article in ESPN News about Michael Phelps, who now is the most decorated Olympian of all time. I mean, he's just crushing it out of the park. He's still winning medals. I mean, just amazing. And I was struck by that because for his coach is celebrating something that happened at the London Games that on the surface, perhaps we might not celebrate if we were in that position. It says this: for the past 15 years, Bob Bowman has watched Michael Phelps transform from an ornery 11-year-old into the greatest swimmer who ever lived. He's been there for all the medals, all of the awards, and all the nail-biting finishes. He served as a father figure at times, teaching Phelps about life, how to drive a stick shift, and how to tie a tie. He goes on to say, but ask Bob Bowman about when he's felt the greatest sense of pride for his pupil, and the coach will now tell you, the moment came on the night of Tuesday, July 31st, 2012, after a race that Phelps lost. And I found that interesting. And what he goes on to say is, if you watched it, you saw Michael Phelps lost to a guy from South Africa, Leclos. And this guy, Leclos, was younger than Phelps and actually idolized him. He said he's the greatest Olympian that ever lived. And so for him to win against Michael Phelps was like the biggest accomplishment of this guy's life. But Michael Phelps was pretty ticked off about it. And Bob Bowman says he watched Phelps get out of the pool utterly angry, upset at himself, upset at the outcome, go into the cool-down pool because he had to kind of pull himself together for the other events that he was swimming in that day. He said, but when they got to the award stand and they were giving out the medals, he said Michael was in a rare situation because he was in the silver medal category, not the gold. He said, but I saw a smile break over Michael's face, and a smile broke out in my face. He said, because Michael Phelps was able to, in defeat, look at the person who had won and celebrate what that success meant to him. And he saw humility in Michael Phelps. He saw a character building in him in that moment that made Bob Bowman as his coach smile. And he said later on, Michael was even able to coach Leclos on how to hold the gold medal as you take all the pictures, because obviously he's got a lot of experience with that. And it was just awesome to see that. And it just reminded me that, you know, in the midst of the good life, there are these things that happen. And when difficulty happens, when pain happens, when suffering happens, I think our natural inclination is to disconnect that and say, this can no way be connected to the good life. But I think the story that God tells is different than that. And so today, I just got to tell you, this is a message I feel like I have to give. Because the last thing I want is for you to leave this summer series thinking that what we're saying in the midst of this is the good life is about looking on the bright side only. The good life is about grin and bear it. Go out and find 5 great places to eat ice cream. Go find places to have great food and forget about the suffering in your life. That's it, and just live the good life. That's not what we're saying. And today, what I want you to know is this. This is the thesis for today, and I'm going to spend the rest of the time unpacking it, and hopefully you can track with me and we can engage on this together, because I really believe that in the midst of a life that does have good things but also has suffering, there is something to be said about the ability to notice the light and not be overcome by the darkness. To notice the light and not be overcome by the darkness, because I know that in this life, oftentimes, it is hard to see the light. I said this is a message I have to give because of the community I'm in, because of people I know around here who are suffering right now. A friend of mine was in Columbus earlier this week because her brother-in-law had brain surgery for a tumor that took the life of his sister, and the doctors are giving him only months to live. There's a great family here at Crossroads, really connected to the community. Their son earlier this week was hit by a car in northern Kentucky, and he is lying in a coma in Children's Hospital right now. I was talking to another friend of mine, and a mutual friend we have, his wife served him divorce papers this week. My aunt was in town a couple weeks ago, and she had a little bit of a scare when she was here, took her to Jewish Hospital. She had an allergic reaction. I called my mom yesterday just to check in, see how things are going, and I found out my aunt is in the intensive care unit in a hospital in Philadelphia right now. And I just know that that's just the little bit that I know. I've talked to people in the atrium this week who are facing emergency evictions. And I just know that there's a lot of people who right now you would not say you're living the good life. Right now you are in pain. Right now you are suffering. You're processing through evil in all kinds of ways. And you're trying to ask the question, what does it look like to see the light in the midst of that? And I know it's hard to see. Earlier this year, I had one of those moments that perhaps you've had before, about trying to notice the light and not be overcome by the darkness. A friend of mine, whose name is Brian, not Brian Tone, but another Brian, guy I was growing in friendship with, he was diagnosed with a liver cancer. And I just got to tell you, like, I just knew he was going to be one of those miracle stories. I know God heals. I've seen God heal. And I was just, like, excited about how God was going to work out this healing in Brian's life. I mean, this salt-of-the-earth guy, young, incredibly healthy, and bunch of people praying for him. And I just knew he was going to pull through. And actually, within a matter of months, he was gone. And he left behind a wife and three boys. And as a father of boys myself, it was hard to see the light. It was hard to see the light. And when you get to that place, you ask those why questions. And I'm just going to tell you today, I'm not going to necessarily answer your why question. I don't know that I can. I don't know that anybody can. But I do believe that there are some things that we can know about God, and particularly we can know about Jesus, that help us in the midst of even not having that why question answered when we face pain and we face suffering. I believe it's possible to notice the light and not be overcome by the darkness in this world. You know, a friend of mine is an optometrist, and so I was thinking about this this message because the kind of the story we're going to look at in the book of John today is Jesus interacting with a man who was born blind. And I asked my friend, I said, you know, is it fair to say that blindness, whatever the cause is basically an absence of light? Is that true? And he said, well, that's not technically true, but what is technically true is that all blindness is caused by either the eye, the optic nerve, or the brain's inability to either receive light or utilize light. And so that physical reality of blindness connects to the spiritual reality of being able to notice the light and not be overcome by the darkness. In fact, Jesus uses the same kind of I language to say this. Actually, this was John earlier as he's talking about Jesus' role in the story. And he says, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. John is introducing the stories that he's going to tell of his interactions with Jesus. And he wants us to know that Jesus represents light. He represents light coming against the darkness. And he even offers up the conclusion of the story, which is the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. And you know, Jesus understood that for many of us, it's hard sometimes to see that light. It's hard sometimes to see light in the midst of darkness. This is another place where Jesus is recognizing that. And he's talking about the role of the eye. The spiritual eye is really what he's talking about in Matthew chapter 6, where Jesus says these words. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And what Jesus is saying here is, in the spiritual sense, In the spiritual sense, there is a such thing as the inability to receive or utilize light. There is a sense of blindness. And if we're living in that place, it is hard not to be overcome by the darkness. But what Jesus wants us to know is over and against the darkness in this world, he has come to bring light. He has come to bring light. And you know, I know whenever you talk about suffering, when you talk about pain and evil in the world, the problem of evil, the problem of pain, I just want to say I'm coming against pat answers in what I'm saying today. That's why I want you to hang in there with me. We're going to wade through some stuff because it isn't a simple answer, and I don't think the pat answers are helpful. You know, at some point, if you're wrestling with suffering, if you're open to the idea of God, even if you may not necessarily say you're fully believing in that, but if you're open to the idea that there is a God, then at some point you ask the question, what is his role in pain and suffering? If there is a God, what's his role in it? It's probably one of the biggest objections people have to the existence of God. And even if you believe that there is a God, it's one of the biggest challenges you have in your faith is when you come to a place in life where you're experiencing evil, pain, and suffering, and you have to ask the question, where is God in all of this? And I think there are two pat answers that I don't find helpful. And the first is some people, and they may not say it in these words, but in essence what they're saying is God is for the darkness. God is for the darkness. God causes it. God is judging people, so when bad things happen, we have some folks in the last service just came back from New Orleans, and they're still down there building houses and had a great time. And, you know, I remember when Katrina happened, there were people, religious people, who said, that's God's judgment on that sinful and evil city. And I don't know, I mean, when you say that, what you're saying is God is in some way for the darkness, and I don't know how you reconcile all of that with the God of the Bible who I see full of grace and love and light. I mean, there's a lot of tension in that for me. I don't think that pat answer is really helpful. But on the flip side, I think there are other people who have the pat answer of God is not able to do anything about the darkness, that he's not powerful enough to come against it. And the extreme of that argument is there is no God. And so suffering and pain and all the things we face in life, it's just random. There's no reason to it. And I just say, for me, and I'm not saying everybody in here agrees with where I am on this, but for me, neither of those answers are helpful. I think they're pat answers that are not helpful. Because the question I want to pose is, what if there's more to the story? What if there are other factors in the midst of this world of pain and suffering where we do see elements of the light? What if there are other factors there? And I want to submit to you that that's what the Bible narrative really describes for us. And when I use the word narrative, I'm talking about the overarching story that the Bible is communicating. And I don't believe it's a fiction story. When I use that word narrative, I'm talking about the story that shapes the reality that we see. You know, there's a narrative for our country. There's a narrative of independence. There's a narrative of freedom in our country. That narrative shapes how we think about things in the United States. That narrative isn't based on fiction. It's based on real events that happened about 200 plus years ago. A lot of those happened in the city that I was born in Philadelphia. I've been to Independence Hall. Those are real places. There were real people writing real documents like the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. And it shaped this nation. That narrative is real, and it defines in a lot of ways the reality of what our country is and what our country has become. And I'm submitting to you, and I know everybody may not be here, but I'm submitting to you, the Bible is a narrative that describes the reality we live in this world. We did a whole series on this a couple years ago. Some of the stuff I'm going to give you now, I'm going to try to give you like a 30,000-foot view of that narrative. But we did 8 weeks on it a couple years ago, and you can download that for free at crossroads.net. And I encourage you to do that if you haven't checked out the story series before to do that. But this narrative that the Bible describes really points to the fact that there are other factors involved in this world, and perhaps understanding those other factors enables us to know God's position when it comes to suffering and pain in this world. In fact, that narrative begins with the very first words of the Bible in the very first book of the Bible. The book of Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 and 2. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the water. You know, when I read this, and I've spent a lot of time listening to people who have spent their whole lives, really, some of them, understanding these passages, and I've wrestled with this in conversation with other people and done my own reading and my own praying and processing, and I see a lot in this. This is loaded stuff. These first paragraphs in the Bible are loaded. You know, what this says is, in the beginning, God created, and God created the heavens and the earth. That means, yes, God created land, and he also created stars and sun, but God created this physical realm of the earth that we experience, but there's also a spiritual realm that God created. And there are physical beings called men and women who God has created, and there are also spiritual beings who at this point in the story are called angels that God has created. And what we know from later in the narrative of the Bible is that there was a rebellion in the spiritual realm, and that an angel that was created by God, who now is called Satan, and I don't believe Satan is a fictional character. I believe he's a real spiritual personality that is hell-bent, literally, on you not experiencing the good life. When he rebelled against God, God threw him to the earth. He threw him out of the heavenly realm where God existed in his fullness, and he threw him to the earth. And in the midst of that, it's interesting because the word in Genesis, when it says God created the heavens and the earth, and then it says now the earth was formless and void, the word for formless and void, that phrase is actually in the original language the word chaos. It's actually saying that at this point things were disordered. They were disordered, and I believe part of that disorder was because of this rebellion that happened in the spiritual realm. And yet in the midst of disorder, we see God bringing order. In fact, you can imagine this playing out like a play on a stage. Everything we just read is narration. It's the opening narration to the story. But the first words that are spoken by the main character of the story, God, are literally the words, "Let there be light." So from the very beginning, God is coming against the darkness. And I believe that every time God acts, he's doing that. He's doing that every time. The story says that Adam and Eve were created, and at some point, Adam and Eve chose to go away from the light of God. And you can imagine, if you just think about it, it stands to reason that if you turn away from the light, you're turning to darkness. And they were tempted to do that by the rebel, by Satan. And I just want to submit that the Bible says that there are other factors at play in this world. And those factors play a role in evil and suffering. In Ephesians 6:12, it says our struggle is not only against flesh and blood. Doesn't mean that sometimes evil doesn't take flesh and blood forms. Obviously, we know that. We know there are physical people doing things that are a part of the evil and suffering in this world. We know there's a physical thing like sickness that's a part of the reality of this world. But our struggle, the Bible says, is not only against flesh and blood, but it says it's against spiritual powers, and it actually uses the word dark forces of this world because we have an enemy. And in the midst of that story, what we need to know is that God is not for the darkness. And in fact, every time God acts, he's coming against the darkness. I want to submit to you that every time God acts in history, it is him once again saying, "Let there be light." Every time he acts, that is the nature and the character of who he is. And so when Jesus enters this narrative, John picks up on this light-darkness thing, and he says, "In Jesus was life. And that life was the light of men. And the light came into the world, and the darkness cannot overcome it." And so we need to look at what Jesus is doing through those lenses. And that's a lot of background, a lot of backdrop to talk about an interaction that Jesus had with a man who was born blind. And we see this in John chapter 9. In fact, in the chapter right before this, Jesus has declared to those who are in hearing that he is the light of the world. He's finished saying that, and it says as he was going along with his disciples, as he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Remember how I talked about those pat answers? Well, you know what? The disciples are betraying that they have believed one of these pat answers about why suffering happens. You know, it's interesting. This man was born this way. He was born blind. And so the disciples come across him, and we don't know how they knew that he was born blind. Maybe he was a well-known figure in that city because of that. But they ask, "So who sinned? Whose fault is it? Whose fault is it that he is born blind? Did this man sin or did his parents sin?" Now, let's stop and unpack this for a minute. This man was born this way. So the disciples are saying, did he sin while he was in his mother's womb? I'll just be honest with you, intellectually, I can't go there. Or is this punishment for the sins of his parents? Well, now that's really encouraging for anybody who's ever faced a miscarriage or anybody who's ever lost a child. And again, these pat answers are not helpful. What's interesting is Jesus comes against that pat answer, because this is what Jesus says. Jesus says, neither this man nor his parents sinned. Jesus said, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Now, you could look at that and say, okay, here's Jesus giving a bad answer. No, no, no. It's not that his parents sinned. It's not that this man sinned. No, 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 no. God had a greater purpose, and so he had this guy be born blind and have his whole life tanked and ruined so that one day when I came, I could heal him, it could be in the Bible, and people could know that I heal blind people. And I want to submit to you that's not what Jesus is saying. In fact, the Greek language has very different grammatical structure than English, and sometimes that gets lost in translation, in our English translations of the Bible. I believe this is one of the places where this is not necessarily the way you have to interpret and articulate these words. I believe, and there are a lot of great scholars who support this, so I didn't make this up, and they didn't make this up to excuse anything. This is just true of the Greek language. You could read that sentence this way. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, period. But let God's will be done in his life now. And that is, in fact, what Jesus is saying. What Jesus is saying is this the wrong question to ask, well, whose fault is it? It's not about whose fault it is. Here's what we know. Whenever Jesus comes against darkness, he is always coming to bring light. So he says, hey, here's darkness. This man is born blind. There's been pain. There's been difficulty in his life. Let God's will be done. Today, the light is coming. In fact, that's exactly what Jesus does as he heals this man. Listen to the dialogue as he prepares to heal him. Jesus says, as long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. What are those works? Coming against the darkness with the light. Jesus says, night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. After saying this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. That is absolutely gross. And then he says, go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. What does Jesus do when he comes against the darkness? Jesus says, I've come to bring light. So whenever there's darkness, Jesus comes and he brings the light. What's interesting is this very gross thing of him making mud with his saliva. I think he's even communicating in that you need to know that God's work against the darkness is active. It is present. It is happening right now. That God literally gets in the mud with you in the midst of your darkness to bring light. I really believe that Jesus is communicating in even how he heals this man, that God is always, always, always bringing light against the darkness. But you know why that's so difficult for us to believe? Or do you know why that gets challenged when we're in the face of suffering? I think the reason is because our perspective on time is so different from God's. Our perspective on time is so different from God. I mean, just think about your life. Some of you I know are in a tough spot right now. And some of you have been in a tough spot before. And man, when you're in a difficult place, when you're in the midst of pain and suffering, time slows down. And every 24 hours feels like an eternity, especially if at the end of that 24 hours, there is no resolution. Time slows down. And yet, if you have been in a period of suffering before that now you're some years removed from, I bet you that if we sat down over coffee, you would tell me you have a different perspective of what was happening in that time. I mean, even us in our finite human thinking have the ability with time to see things from a different perspective as we get further and further from the situation. Now, if that's true for us, just imagine the difference between our perspective on time and God's perspective on time. And I just want to submit that perhaps the pat answers come because we're trying to gain control of something that really is beyond us. Or we're trying to control a God who we really cannot control. And we can't fully grasp his mind. You know, I really believe science sometimes is very helpful in putting these pieces together for us. And particularly when it comes to this perspective of time, there is a scientific discovery that really helps put me in my place as to the difference between my perspective on time and God's perspective on time. You know, if I were to ask the guys to turn down the lights in here, the guys who work the lights, turn it down and make it dark in this room, you know, and if that was just a flip of the switch, then all I would have to do is say, hey, turn the lights back on. And when they did, for us, in our instant, it would be like a click, switch is flipped, light comes back on. It would happen in an instant. But because we can look at subatomic particles now, we know some things about what's happening in the midst of darkness when that light gets switched on. And in fact, they've discovered a particle that's called a muon. And a muon's entire life is from the time, exists from the time when the light switch comes on to when light fills the room. For you and I, that's a click and it's done. But for a muon, that time period is their entire lifespan. So I want you to imagine for a moment that you are a muon. Not a moron, a muon. If you were a muon and it was dark in this room, you'd be hanging around with your other muon friends, doing whatever muons do in the dark. And, you know, maybe there's a muon named Alan that you're trying to find. So you'd be saying, Alan, Alan, Alan. If you were here for the animal video, I love that. You know, maybe not Alan. Steve, Steve. So, you know, you'd be doing whatever muons do. And then all of a sudden you hear a click. And you would know, okay, the click. Okay, light is coming. But from a muon's perspective, what it would feel like, what you would experience, is way over in this section of the room, you would experience a speck of light when that click happens. But it would be half of your entire life before half of this room filled with light. That'd take half of your life to see. And so you could imagine if you were a muon named Bono, that you would write songs about that. How long to sing this song? You know, you'd write songs about the, there's light and it's a speck, but it's half my life. And even when you got to this point of your life as a muon, it would take the rest of your life before you saw light enter the room fully. But for you and I, click, light switch, light fills the room. I want to submit to you, that's the difference between how we see time and how God sees time. And that's the difference between our ability to notice the light and not be overcome by the darkness. But I want you to know that the light switch has already been flipped on. That light switch moment, I believe, happened at a point in history when Jesus died on the cross. You know, this is the part of the message where I would say, if you knew you were coming to church today, so it's probably not a big plot twist that the preacher's talking about Jesus dying on the cross. You're not sitting there like, whoa, whoa. You're going to talk about Jesus dying on the cross in church? Oh, my goodness. Didn't see that coming. No, you know that's coming. But here's what I want you to know. You probably have heard that, and you've probably heard that Jesus did that for your sins. And that's absolutely true. And it's absolutely so much more. So what I want to do is try to give you a perspective on the cross that is richer and that actually speaks to the whole idea of light overcoming darkness. You know, it is true that Jesus died on the cross, that he was punished, that he was suffering on the cross. And what the story of the Bible is, what that narrative says is that happened because when we turned away from God and darkness entered the world, there's just a brokenness that needed to be mended. And there is a price for that mending. And in fact, in Isaiah 53, there are words that were written 500 years before Jesus was ever born. And these words are so profound in the context of him dying on the cross. They're absolutely pointing to him, pointing to what he would do. And it actually, if you look in your Bible in Isaiah 53, it probably has the title in that section of the suffering servant. And this is what it says about Jesus' death on the cross. It says, but he was pierced for our transgressions. He was pierced for the ways that we transgressed away from the light. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. What this is saying is when Jesus stepped into humanity, it was God stepping into humanity, and when he did that, what we need to know is that was God stepping into our suffering. And man, this is mind-blowing. One philosopher said that the divine gave up their divine right to be aloof and distant from pain. And in Jesus, we see the divine stepping in to our suffering. We see infinity stepping into our finite understanding of pain and suffering. And so Jesus hangs on the cross. And Jesus says, how long? He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? It is literally God stepping in and completely feeling suffering. And that's what it means. When people say he died for your sins, he stepped into the suffering that you and I feel. And he took on that suffering for himself. The suffering that we deserved. He suffered even greater than we did. Because he suffered this eternal separation. We never have to because of what he did. But the cross is so much more. I do believe that the cross was the greatest plot twist in this story. I do believe that those spiritually dark forces could not have anticipated what was coming next. How many people have ever seen the movie Sixth Sense, M. Night Shyamalan's movie, with Bruce Willis? Another movie like that for me is The Book of Eli, Denzel Washington. Love that movie. I love movies like that. I love movies where, literally, in the last 30 seconds of the film, it makes me wonder, what in the heck was I looking at for the last hour and a half? I didn't fall asleep. I was paying attention. I was listening to the dialogue. I was looking for all the context clues. But I didn't know Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. I didn't know that. There's a friend of mine who teaches film. He's really upset that I'm telling you all the ending to a movie that was filmed 15 years ago. But I told him, get over it. So, you know, I mean, the reality is, like, when that happens in a movie, it just completely changes everything. And all of a sudden, in 30 seconds, everything that happened before comes into the light. And everything that's going to happen from that point forward comes into the light. And I want you to know that as Jesus stepped into our suffering, what happened 3 days later was this kind of plot twist that you see in Sixth Sense. Because here's the thing, if suffering was going to win, if the darkness was going to win, then if God came and died, if God came and experienced death, that would be the final victory for death, right? Because the greatest thing about suffering, the greatest blow suffering can give us, is death. That's why our hearts break when we lose people, because there is a finality to death on this side of things. Because when we see things happening across the world, we're heartbroken for people who are dying because of conflicts and struggles in the world. And if death was the final word, well, then the darkness actually overcame the light. But if somebody ever beat death, well, then the light has won. So what I want you to know is when Jesus stepped into our suffering on the cross, that was absolutely the beginning of the greatest plot twist in history, because 3 days later, Jesus swallowed up death whole because he rose again. And it was the greatest plot twist. It was the greatest plot twist that ever happened in this story. In fact, as people look back on the resurrection, this is what they say about it. Paul says this in 1 Corinthians. He says, death has been swallowed up in victory. So I want you to know, when Jesus died and rose again, it was the flipping on of the light switch. The light has come, and the darkness has not overcome it. And even though for you and for me, we feel like muons and it's taking forever, I want you to know that God is always acting against the darkness. He's always been acting against the darkness. He always will be acting against the darkness. And at the moment that Jesus rose from the dead, it was clear that the light switch had been turned on, and eventually the light will win. And that changes how we look at suffering. That changes how we look at pain in our lives. Because the light has come and the darkness has not overcome it. You know, I talked earlier about how science can really help us to solidify truth. There's another thing I want to do with you now that for me has helped me solidify this truth. I want you to experience this. You know, I talked earlier about if we were muons and I asked the folks to turn down the lights, that we would experience kind of a little bit of that different time perspective. Well, I'm going to ask them to do that now. So, fair warning, this is not time to get up and go to the bathroom. It's going to get dark in here. But guys, go ahead and turn down all those lights. You know, in this room right now, it is very dark. And yet, there's still strips of light by the steps and the exit signs and all that. We're not going to turn those off. But I want you to go there in your mind, if you could. Imagine that every light in this room was off and that it was absolutely dark in this room. And I want you to know that this may be the reason God allowed the iPhone to be invented. Can you see this light? Let me ask you a question. If it was as dark as it could be in this room, could we turn up the darkness more to the point where this light would not show? Couldn't do it. The laws of nature say that is physically impossible. You can obstruct the light, but you can't block it. You can't turn up the darkness over the light. Now, here's what I want you to do. Do you have anything on your person that illuminates? I want you to take it out and I want you to shine it. Look at the light. Look at the light. Wait, that's a lot of light. Let's turn up the darkness. Let's turn up the darkness so we can snuff out this light. We can't do it. We can't do it. You know why? Because when the light comes, the darkness can never overcome it. Guys, you can turn on the rest of the lights. We can turn up light, but we can't turn up darkness. And I tell you, this changes how you look at the darkness. Jesus even said, in this world, you will have trouble. He said, but take heart, because I have overcome the world. And I believe that that is true. I believe that's true because of what happened on the cross, and I believe that's true because of the empty grave. It doesn't mean that when we suffer, we don't feel the pain. It doesn't mean that we look on the bright side and ignore the difficulties in this life. It doesn't mean that we won't grieve. It doesn't mean that we won't hurt. It doesn't mean that we should ever make peace with evil. I just want to submit to you that God is always coming against the darkness, that his work is active and always redemptive, and that in the end, I believe God will win. Fyodor Dostoevsky is a Russian writer, Russian author, and he did not live the good life. As I read about his life, in a lot of ways, he did not live the good life. Imprisoned for many of the things that he wrote, lost people very close to him in tragic ways, and yet he wrote, I believe, some of the most profound words about how to notice the light amidst the darkness, and I want to share them with you. This is what he said. I believe like a child, that suffering will be healed and made up for, that all the humiliating absurdity of human contradictions will vanish like a pitiful mirage, like the despicable fabrication of the impotent and infinitely small Euclidean mind of man. I think I have one of those minds. I don't know what half of those words mean. That in the world's finale, at the moment of eternal harmony, something so precious will come to pass that it will suffice for all hearts, for the comforting of all resentments, for the atonement of all the crimes of humanity, for all the blood that they've shed, that it will make it not only possible to forgive, but to justify all that has happened. Whew. I mean, look, just between you and me, can we just agree that that is crazy talk? Unless Jesus died. Unless he rose again. And I believe that he has, and I believe that he did. And because of that, I believe that the light has come, that the darkness will never overcome it. So I told you, if you hang in there with me with all this heady, theological, scientific, all this stuff, that I'll tell you this is an eminently practical. And here's the one application I have for you today. When you are in the face of evil, when it feels like the darkness wants to overcome you, I just want to submit to you to look to Jesus, to define the character of God, not your circumstances. Look to the Jesus who steps into your suffering on the cross and know that when you are suffering, it cannot be because God is for the darkness. It cannot be because God doesn't love you, because God stepped into your suffering and he bore wounds for you. Look to the Jesus who died on the cross and know that it cannot be that God is not powerful enough to overcome the darkness, because 3 days later after Jesus died, death was swallowed up in victory. And know that God has all of eternity to make it right, but that he is moving in that direction, that the light switch has been flipped on, light is coming, and the darkness cannot overcome it. I believe we can notice the light, and that when we do, we are not overcome by the darkness. So just a couple practical encouragements for you. What does it look like to look to Jesus? You know, maybe you're here and, you know, you've been able to follow me today as I talk about this story, but you wouldn't necessarily say, yeah, I agree with everything, and I don't know that I would make all the mental leaps that you've made about Jesus and the role and story he plays and all of that. And I just want you to know, man, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're here. That's what this community is for, to be a place where we can just explore that stuff together. And what I would encourage you is maybe what looking to Jesus looks like is downloading the story series that I talked about. It's free. You can download it, get copies of it at the Info Center. Just whatever you need to do, just engage in the story of God. Engage in this narrative. Maybe you're at a place where you would say, I'd love to do that in the context of community. Where there's a group that's going to be starting in a couple months. And if you're interested in that, just sign up at thestoryatcrossroads.net. We'd love for you to be a part of that group when it launches. And it's just going to be a place for people who say, I don't know that I would say I'm a Jesus follower or fully believing that, but I love the dialogue about that story of Jesus and understand my role in it. Just encourage you to do that. Another way that you can look to Jesus, and particularly this is for people who are suffering right now, is I just know when I am in the midst of suffering and time feels like it's moving slow, man, hope is so elusive. And I've just found that when I allow other people to pray for me, that in some ways they lend their hope to mine. And that's incredibly strengthening. And I want you to know that as we wrap up today, we've got a prayer team who would love to pray with you. And so if you're at a place where it's hard right now to see the light, or you feel like you're being overcome by the darkness, I just encourage you to hang in your seat afterwards. You don't have to do anything. They will come to you, and they would love to pray with you. We're going to sing the song that we sung earlier, be strong, take courage, don't live in fear. Your God's not distant. Your words he'll hear. For some of us, maybe this song's a declaration. For others of us, it's a request. For others of us, it's a desire. We want to believe that. Wherever we are, I just want to encourage you that God is for you, and he's willing to meet you right where you are. So God, as we sing this song, I just pray that we would sense your presence right now, and that we would know that you are always for us, and you are always bringing light against the darkness in our lives. Amen.